Welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, a work of the Jesuits in Britain. I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s and I used to live in a Jesuit young adult community. We all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you to take a moment to stop and think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. Every week I meet a new guest who tells me about something they experienced which changed their life forever. By talking about the things they wish they'd known, we'll explore the idea that God is in all things. And we'll talk about the part that faith plays in navigating life's challenges. Today I'm speaking to Antonia. Antonia shares her journey of healing from childhood abuse, how her faith both broke and rebuilt her trust, and the way that God has shown up through community, courage, and accompaniment. Antonia's story is going to be shared in two parts. In this first part, she shares about how being challenged led her to action and created what is now called Loud Fence. For me, it's a reminder of how a small action can lead to something greater. What Antonia shares can be difficult to hear, and if you've been affected by her story, please do look at the links that we've shared and hopefully some way it can support you. So Antonia, what was your experience of growing up in the church?
This is the thing, my experiences were golden. So my background is that I am a survivor of familial abuse from the age of seven. And when you are in a situation like that, you don't have anybody to compare notes with. So you think that what's happening to you is only happening to you. And you're, especially my abuser, he told me, well, you're the one who's having this effect on me and you're the one who's making me do this to you. So that kind of made me really shut down. I carried an awful lot of shame. And also I believe that if there was something about me that was making someone abuse me, then I was the problem and I shouldn't talk to anyone. So I was really shut down. And I think that if you make it through that, it's because there's somebody somewhere who loves you and supports you. And for me, that was my parish priest, Father Damien, growing up. So he was my friend and mentor and teacher. And he was an art fanatic and a Marianologist. So he would spend ages talking to all of us about fine art and art history. You know, he's dead, unfortunately, but I still have a bucket list of things and of art that I have to go and look at because, you know, I can still hear him talking about it and saying, isn't this amazing? Isn't this wonderful? So that's what it was like for me growing up in the church. And I think it's because I had this vision of what the church is really supposed to be like that drives me on to do what I do, really.
And can you tell us a bit about how your healing journey began?
Well, I suppose it's kind of been an odd journey because I could never tell Father Damien about what happened. But the fact that he was there and he accompanied me made all the difference in the world. He never knew it, but he actually made a huge difference. And so I grew up, I was lucky that I met a wonderful man and I got married and had three children. And so if I fast forward to 2018, you know, I'm a mother of three. And I remember coming home one evening, I've been helping out at Brownies. And it's one of those watershed moments, you know, like everyone remembers where they were when they heard that Lady Diana died. It was one of those things for me. So I came home, got the kids to bed, and I put the 10 o'clock news on. And at 10 o'clock in the evening, I was a practicing Catholic. And at 12 minutes past 10, my whole world had just completely ceased as I understood it, because the Pennsylvania grand jury report into child abuse in the Catholic Church over there in the States came on. And for me, it was just incomprehensible what I heard. I knew that there had to be abusers in the church because there's abusers everywhere. It's where there are people, there is abuse. But for me, the thing that I couldn't come to terms with was the fact that it was organized and it was systematically covered up, that it wasn't just something that happened. It was a way of being, a way of dealing with something. And it was just so at odds with my experience of the church. And something in me just cracked. That's the only way really I can describe it. I don't remember going to bed that night. And the next morning I got up and, you know, the floor and the curtains and the furniture were all the same, but I didn't know where I was. And the GP said, you know, she's in shock. And I remember going to my parish priest where I lived in Southwest Scotland. So, you know, it's easy to judge people's reactions, but in retrospect, I don't know what he was going through or, you know, how he had received that news, because it was probably a shock to him too. But he was really defensive when I tried to speak to him, and he said, so what are you trying to say then, that we're all abusers? And I was just no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that I'm in a really bad place and I need to talk. But he wasn't there. That's not something he felt comfortable doing. And so a couple of weeks later, I attempted to speak to the parish safeguarding officer, who's an Irish Catholic, GP, and a mother of five with lead responsibility for safeguarding in her parish. So one would assume that this would be somebody that you could speak to about this issue. And she was quite blasé about it. And she said, well, you know, the church has always been like that. And besides, it wasn't your kids. What's your problem? And so for me, that for me just kind of confirmed everything I had been told on the television. So, you know, popular press is not particularly charitable to the church anyway, but it just felt like these people were basically corroborating everything that the television was saying. And I suppose what happened was I didn't lose my faith, but I lost my capacity to practice my faith because I didn't feel safe in church. And that, so what happened was I stayed away from church. I couldn't go to church. And in one way that fixed something, because that immediate hurt that's so painful and you want it to stop, stops. But then you're left with another pain that replaces it. And that's, you're left with this giant church-shaped hole in your life where your capacity to be the church or part of the church once was. And you're left with grief. That's the only way I can describe it, is unbearable grief. That's how I would express it. And so that's what brought me on this journey. I started a journey of looking for other people. The television was full of people, commentators, saying you don't need a church to be a Christian. And I thought, well, this is the rest of my life. So if I can't go back to church and I'm not giving up my faith, then how practically do you practice your faith without the church? And I went out looking for people.
So what did you find?
What did I find? Well, there's another world out there. And it was one that was right in front of us, but we never questioned. So I met a couple who were baptized their fourth child on the beach at St. Ninian's Cave. They'd gone back to the beginning, to the cradle of Christianity in Scotland, to baptize their child with a Catholic baptismal rite. It's valid, but I don't think it's licit. They asked me to be a godparent, but I didn't say yes because I didn't actually know what I was agreeing to, because everything was up in the air and I didn't know what that would mean exactly. I found a lady in Annan who spent the last 40 years praying alone in her sitting room and volunteering at a food bank as a way of practicing her faith, because her brother was abused in the church and they were all shunned. I found another couple down in Dorset and another couple who'd gone through the same thing in Yorkshire. And they were both young Catholics who'd got married in hotels with secular celebrants using Catholic marriage rites in hotels because they felt that going back to church was saying we accept the status quo, but we're not giving up our faith. And these people all described themselves as being part of the same group, and that is can't be Catholic, but can't be anything but Catholic, and they can't go back, and they don't know how to go forward. And so they're trying their best to practice their faith in this nondescript limbo that nobody has any rules or structure for. So that's what I found. And so when I moved to Cumbria, I had to go there to get my son a place at a specialist school. I was for staying in my shed and being a churchless Christian. And as I say, everything that happened to me, well, it's the complete opposite of everything I planned.
I was going to add, it's almost that separation of your relationship with God separately from your relationship with the church, in terms of like quite a lot of people, particularly practicing Catholic, your relationship between God and your relationship with church is quite connected. Mm. But for this group of people you've just described, there is that separation of those two relationships. So what did you find in Cumbria?
So I bought an old rectory in a small village in northern Cumbria. My children reliably informed me that I moved them to the most boring village in England, which suited me just fine. It was next to a little medieval church. And so when I moved there, I planned on just being in my shed and, you know, restoring statues, and I don't know what the plan was. It was going to just be me and God, and all the complications were going to stay way over there, and it was going to be just us in our own exclusive little safe club over here. And when I moved there, there were a group of little old ladies in the church there, St. Peter's, and we become very fond of them very quickly. So they asked me my story, and they said, oh, for goodness sake, don't pray in your shed, Antonia. You know, our church is your church, you know, it's next door, go pray in it. So, you know, when they couldn't open the doors or get the grills off the stained glass, you know, I would dutifully send Seb round to fix it for them. And yeah, everything went along quite quietly and peacefully until what happened to me happened to them. So the Anglican Bishop of Carlisle, he wrote a character reference for a convicted priest who abused 2 8-year-old girls. And so this priest was found guilty in court, and he approached his friend, the bishop, for a character reference to procure him a lesser sentence, which would be inexcusable. But this bishop, he wrote the character reference, and at the 59th minute of the 11th hour, somebody in the diocese found out that he'd done this and got him to withdraw the reference. But by that time, it was too late. The die was cast, and the sentencing judge had seen the character reference and was absolutely, and rightly so, excoriating about the bishop, and said, you know, you've added to the suffering of these children and their families by writing this character reference. What, could you not see them? Could you not see what was happening to them? And this came into the public domain in the same week as ICSA. So this had the effect of dropping an atomic bomb on the church in Cumbria. It was, the devastation was absolute, really. And that's ground zero. That's where we started.
For anyone listening, what is ICSA?
ICSA is the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse. It was set up by the then Prime Minister, Theresa May, and it was to look into abuse in major institutions. So that was in local authority care, in some boarding schools, and also in the Catholic Church and in the Anglican Church.
So that report came out at the same time that the bishop's letter was made public.
Yes.
So what happened after that?
Well, I think the thing that made so many ordinary Christians so angry was one that, so I suppose this is an inevitable consequence of the way that the church is structured, that the person at the top speaks for everybody else. And so nobody else, especially when they're in a place of acute pain, they don't get to express how they feel and they don't get to say, I'm so sorry, to anyone who's hurting. And so that's what all these people went through. I remember one of those ladies in church. I remember finding her sat alone one evening crying, and she was just sobbing. I really, to the point where my shirt was wet with the tears when I tried to console her. And I said, what on earth has happened? And she said, my daughter-in-law doesn't feel comfortable about me bringing my grandchildren to church anymore. And this lady had lived in this village for 84 years, her whole life, you know, born and raised and gone to this church. And now she couldn't bring her grandchildren there. And after consoling her, she got a bit angry with me. And she said, why are you just sat here? You know, you've been through this before me. Why haven't you done something? And I was a bit taken aback by this. And I said, well, what do you want me to do? What am I going to do? I kind of read up in my usual prudent style and said, well, what am I supposed to do about it? And she said, well, something, for goodness sake. And I think the thing that kind of caught me off guard was before I left Scotland and moved to Cumbria, I had a row with God on the beach in Scotland. I'm reliably informed by a lot of venerable monks that it wasn't a rowing, it was praying out loud. So that I think they're being very charitable with me there. But this row stroke, rigorous praying on the beach, ended with me saying to God, you have all this power. You can do anything you want. It's your church, so you do what you want with it, because you could do anything. Why don't you do something? And I stormed off the beach in my usual dramatic fashion, and that was that. So to hear that same accusation throwing back in my face kind of took me back for a moment. And so I said, all right, then, I will. Watch this. And I went home, went next door, and my husband said to me, what are you going to do then? And I said, I've no idea. No idea. And Elizabeth's given me 48 hours. Wow. So for the parish council meeting. So I remember thinking, well, I'm an artist. How would I approach this? And I remember from my time living in Scotland, there is a tradition where you memorialise loss and record grief. Before the advent of mass literacy, this is, so going back at least 300, 400 years ago, and that this is where you tied strips of cluthi or clouti or fabric to a tree in your village to denote the loss that's happened. If you didn't have the money to pay for a headstone, or you couldn't write it down in a book, you could record this loss in this way. And so I was kind of looking for a way of expressing the modern version of this. I am officially the last person in the whole of Britain to ever catch up with any kind of modern movement. I think I actually might be the last person to figure out how to text somebody as well. So I was kind of looking around online, and so you had semaphore flags that they used to send messages. And then I come across a protest group in Australia. Now they are an anti-clerical group, but they call the act, this ancient act of tying ribbons to denote loss, a loud fencing. So I kind of thought, right, well, this is the modern name for what we've been doing for centuries. So I said to Elizabeth and to everybody at the parish council, this is what I propose that we do. what has happened is a series, like a domino effect of broken relationships that you can see here. We can't undo the abuse, but we can do everything about what we do now that people have been harmed. So we can either shun them and pretend they're not there, or we can wrap our arms around them and throw the doors of this church open and send them a message saying, you are the victims, you are the priority, and we're here for you in whatever way. This is for you. But how do you do that if you don't even know who they are? Because they're not coming to the church to tell you who they are, and you don't know who they are. So I suppose you could put a message online, but it's cold and impersonal. And there's nothing like the physicality of touching something and it being something that's in the real world rather than a message on a phone. So that's the theory behind Loud Vents. It's the people on the inside coming to the edge of the church, the boundary, the fence, and tying those messages so that the people on the outside can meet them there and see what's been written. And they don't have to say who they are. But actually, we found that the impact it has is really profound. So it's kind of reverse technology. My kids call it medieval Facebook, but I call that human interaction. So
I'm going to be giggling for half an hour. I guess that is true, that quite often what we would have done before phones is movements like that, that we now kind of lost them because our assumption is just to pick up a phone, WhatsApp or text or whatever. Mm. But actually, that, as you said, it can come across quite cold. So there isn't that human connection in the same way with it as well. And I was also really struck about that idea of people coming from inside the church out to meet people where they're at, rather than assuming they'll come in, which is going to be a massive challenge for them. Yeah.
Absolutely. Even for people who retain their faith, there are certain places they'll not go. And there are victims I work with who retain their faith and go to Mass, but they have to drive past three Catholic churches where they remember things happening to go to Mass in a church miles away because they can't, the psychological barriers are just too great for them to go in those buildings. So this is not people just being difficult. This is a real psychological injury that they've suffered. And if somebody couldn't walk, we'd put a wheelchair ramp in for them, wouldn't we? This is another form of injury. So we're just saying, meet these people where they are and make adaptations so that they can access church too.
So how, as a community, well, maybe you've answered it and been talking about this, but how do you start as a community to heal from that pain?
Yeah, it's about the first thing that's fundamental is we've got to ditch the us and them. So this narrative is great if you want to flog newspapers, but it's not good if you want to heal a church. So we have to drop all the assumptions, all the stereotypes. We have to stop assuming that the victims are on the outside and that they're the bad, angry, shouty people that are anti-clerical. We have to stop assuming that everyone on the inside has never been affected by abuse and that we're all the people who know nothing about it. The fact of the matter is that there are victims on the inside. There are people who've never experienced abuse on the outside, but have been very impacted by it. And so instead of it being sort of factionalized, we should see the person before we see the title or the robes or the name. We should just see a human being who's part of the church. And if we adopt the attitude that we all have to accompany each other, this will make such a radical difference. And there's also this assumption that the only people who can help anyone impacted by abuse are therapists. Right, therapists offer care, but not all care has to be therapy. Just sitting down with somebody and listening, offering them a cup of tea and just being there for them. There is no medicine quite like kindness and hope. So I just think that we need to drop all the stereotypes, maybe just meet people where they are and journey with them. The first step in restorative justice is just giving someone the gift of listening, saying, I believe you. It liberates people. I've seen the impact it has.
Before this, you spoke about how quite often there'll be people in church, or sometimes there'll be people in church who have been victims and survivors of abuse, not necessarily from the church, but they have that experience from elsewhere, and they will also be sitting in the church, and that can be challenging for them and for their experience. How, for those people, but for all people, how do the church start to support people as they come forth and able to share their stories?
I think that what's crucial is to not be afraid of it. I am one of those people, and I don't underestimate the challenge for some people of listening to it. My parish priest, when I first started talking to him, I think he was as terrified of listening to me as I was of talking to him. And both of us have gone on this journey together. And now we're going to be holding a Loudfence together in November. I've held Loudfences all over Europe now, and I don't think there's going to be one that will be as emotional as tying a ribbon onto my own parish church railings with the parish priest who gave me back the ability to practice my faith. That's going to be like a super weepy one, that one.
Because you just spoke about how you've been all over Europe. What do you think helps people connect with the movement?
I think what it is, fundamentally, is at the moment there is this idea that if you have a problem with abuse, you can't be in the church and you have to leave. And there is this false narrative that says if you are serious about supporting survivors of abuse, then you have to ditch your faith. You can't be Catholic, you can't be a Christian and care about those people, which is madness, because the whole of the gospel is talking about the care of the other, the Christ who went in search of the lost lamb. That makes no sense to me. You know, we've got kind of a handle on the idea of loving our neighbour and being there for them. So we need to ditch all the stereotypes. As I said before, great for selling newspapers, horrifying for the human soul.
When you talk about that, the stereotypes, I guess there's also the challenge in terms of there are people who've not been involved with abuse at all in the church, who when they talk to people outside of the church, all they hear about is the church is full of abusers. And so they can find that quite heavy, and so they might choose to shut down part of their sharing, which then doesn't create this safe space for people who do want to talk about it inside the church. How do we as a church respond to those two needs at the same time?
So I think that's one of the things that the Loudfence really helps with, because we realised pretty soon on that we couldn't just limit it to people who'd suffered abuse by someone in the church, because there were so many people. The first Loudfence we held, quite by accident, we put our ribbons up and we thought someone as far as Penrith might notice. So my daughter, Kathy, said, Mum, the only way you're going to reach Penrith in a pandemic is to take some pictures and post them on social media. And so we did this. And what we discovered a few days later is that we were getting messages from Australia and America and all over Europe. And these people were saying, this was me, this was my dad, this was my granny, this was the boy I was at boarding school with, the girl I was in guides with, the boy I went to scouts with, the girl I was in care with, this was something I suffered at the hands of my dad or my uncle. The list was overwhelming. And what it taught us was the abuse, this is a pandemic that's everywhere. It's not something specific to the church. The church has handled it badly, but actually society has handled it badly. The Epstein scandal, that is just a lot of people who have all took subconsciously a decision to say, I can't deal with that. I can't handle that. So I'm going to just look the other way. There are people who have attempted to justify their conscience and say, well, it really wasn't my issue, it wasn't my problem, or what was I going to do about it? It was literally a whole load of people who demonstrated moral cowardice. They didn't wake up one morning and decide to be wicked. They just opted to be weak. And that's how this has happened. So to say that abuse is somehow more prevalent in the church is a nonsense. It's something which tragically is common everywhere.
So where have you seen God show up unexpectedly?
Where has God shown up unexpectedly? It's in the experiences, the encounters that I've had with people that have been just, they've left me with conversations and memories that will just stay with me forever, really. There was one lady who contacted me through the local newspaper. So the first loud fence we held caused such a stir that the local newspaper got involved. And they put the story online as well as in print. And somebody forwarded it to a friend of a friend of a friend. And I had a lady call me from Canada. And she said that she was an evacuee in the war. And as a six-year-old, she'd been evacuated to the village where I live. And she got my number from the reporter and telephoned me to say, when I was an evacuee, I was raped by the vicar at the time, and I've carried it around with me my whole life, and it's affected all of my relationships, and I'm not getting any younger, and I don't want to take this story to my grave, and I wanted to ring you up and find out how you would react if I told you this, and to ask you if you think it would be okay if I told my daughters and my grandchildren. And so it made me realise the interconnectedness that we all have, no matter where we are in the world, that what we did in that small village in Cumbria had the ability to change someone's life in Canada. She'd carried it around for 70 years, and we managed to convince her that it would be okay to tell her daughters. We got her in contact with her family doctor who was giving her support. And it won't ever undo all the harm that's been done, but it gives someone a sense of release. And I think, wow, we changed something for somebody when we did that. So how do I think God shows up in those conversations when people say, could I tell you something? And you have the ability to just be there with them for that time. That's when God shows up.
And I imagine for somebody who's sharing their experience, the response of the first person they tell will determine how, if they feel comfortable to share it to others.
It's crucial. It's absolutely crucial. It takes a monumental amount of courage. I mean, these people have been blamed for their own injuries, and you know, the narrative around, oh, did you tempt him? What did you wear? How did you speak to him? Did you catch his eye? Did you make him feel uncomfortable? It's anything to try and put the responsibility for the abuse onto the victim rather than onto the perpetrator. So when they finally get to that place, if they do at all, and they feel able to talk, it's absolutely crucial that you're responding correctly when somebody does say that to you.
If you are somebody in that situation, what is the right way to respond? Because I think if I was in that situation, I would, firstly, I know the first thing to do is to listen and hear. Mm. But I think I would be like, I don't want to say the wrong thing to them. Mm. So what is the correct way to respond?
Well, I'll tell you what not to say. Don't say how come it took you so long to say something. Don't say things such as, well, that was a long time ago. Don't you think you should be over it by now? It's pretty simple stuff. Use open questions, not closed ones. Give someone your undivided attention. And when they finish speaking, if this was something that was non-recent abuse And it's obvious from the age of the person disclosing that their assailant is no longer around, they've died, then the next question should be, what would you like to happen now? They've had all the control taken away from them when they've suffered abuse. So give the control back to them and say, what would you like now? Make them feel empowered and affirmed.
That's really good advice and really helpful for somebody who's in that position to listen. But what do you say to the person, to somebody who might be listening to this now, who's been a victim or survivor and wants to come forward and wants to share their experience and come back to church?
If you've experienced abuse within the church, then please, please tell someone. If you don't feel comfortable telling somebody, then contact us at laofence.com. We can be there to assist you and accompany you to contact safeguarding. We've done that on a number of occasions. But if you do contact safeguarding in any diocese, they are now very aware of how delicate that situation will be, and you'll have a very different response from before. If that's something that you don't feel able to do, you could also speak to Safe Spaces. But please, please tell someone. Also, you could go to your local parish safeguarding officer. You can telephone them. If you go onto your parish website, they'll normally list the name and number for the parish safeguarding officer. There's another person you could disclose to as well. So there are lots of options. But if none of those are something you feel comfortable with, we'll always find a way to help you.
Thank you for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. I know this episode is going to stay with me because Antonia shared about how God showed up for her in ways she wasn't expecting. God can really use our weakest moments. How about you? We'd love to hear how Antonia's story resonated with you. And why not also tell us if you're facing an experience you wish you knew how to look at differently? It might just be something we can help with. You can find out more about this and other themes at thinkingfaith.org. Thank you again for listening. I hope you'll join me again next time on Things I Wish I Knew.